I want you to take a listen to this, because you do remember this. Something strange in the neighborhood. Who you gonna call? Ghostbusters! Who you gonna call? Ghostbusters, indeed. That's 30 years since that summer blockbuster, Ghostbusters, first appeared in cinemas. That's right, I said 30-0. So to mark the anniversary, Sony Pictures are planning a reissue of the movie in cinemas for 1 week at the end of next month. Ghostbusters was probably one of the biggest and most successful horror comedies, can I call it that, ever made. Well, I have to call it that, because this is what I want to talk about. It's remembered fondly by a generation who are kids at the time when it came out in 1984. Arts journalist John Byrne, he's been looking back at the story behind the making of Ghostbusters, and he's here now, armed with the proton pack and the ectoplasm. That's really what it is, isn't it? Oops, sorry. That's really what it is, isn't it, John?
That's it. Proton packs, ectoplasm, all that sort of
thing. That was a bit of ectoplasm going on there. Yeah. It's in the very unlikely event, by the way, that anybody listening hasn't seen Ghostbusters. Remind us of the story. By the way, can I just say that this is a terrible start of the story. I hated that movie, and I think the song is worse.
Right.
It's the worst of the 80s. Now, go on, beat that.
Oh, my God. What can I say? Okay, I didn't like the song, but anyway, I'll try and defend the movie.
The song is awful.
Okay, well, basically, the film, if anybody hasn't seen it, it's basically a horror comedy, like you said, about these three parapsychologists, these three academics who investigate the paranormal, called Peter Venkman, played by Bill Murray, Raymond Stantz, played by Dan Aykroyd, and Egon Spengler, played by the late Harold Ramis, who get fired from their jobs at Columbia University in New York, and they're forced to open this ghost-catching business known as Ghostbusters. Anyway, it becomes successful, and they take on a fourth member, Winston, played by Ernie Hudson, and they're hired by a character called Dana Barrett, who's played by Sigourney Weaver, whose fridge, of all things, is haunted by a demon called Zool, and then they eventually have to save New York City and the entire world from this kind of god of destruction called Gozer, who people remember appearing at the end of the film in the shape of a giant marshmallow man. So that's the basic story.
Okay, so it's based on a true story.
Yeah,
let's talk about the making of the film. The main driving force behind it, Dan Aykroyd, ghosts, supernatural and all that. He was really into that as a kid growing up, was he?
Yeah, well, actually, you know, even though it was a comedy, it's worth stressing that Dan Aykroyd himself is actually a believer. He really does believe in ghosts. And if you look at his background, it's probably no wonder. His great-grandfather was a very well-known spiritualist. His grandfather, who was a telephone engineer, he actually investigated if it was possible to contact ghosts or the dead using radio technology. I don't know if he succeeded. And his dad wrote a book called A History of Ghosts, which Dan wrote the introduction for. So, I mean, that's some pedigree.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's kind of hard to think of anyone in Hollywood who was kind of better placed to write a screenplay about ghosts and the paranormal and all that kind
of thing. Right, so Dan Aykroyd wrote the script, did he?
He did, the original screenplay, yeah.
Okay, and the original idea then was different for the movie, though. The original cast was different as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, the original screenplay, which he wrote on his own, Dan Aykroyd, he presented to Ivan Reitman, who went on to direct the film, and that involved time travel and different dimensions and different planets and real high concept sort of stuff. And anyway, it would have cost a fortune to make, so Reitman basically suggested, to save money, basically, that he set the film in the here and now and he remove all of that kind intergalactic, interdimensional fantasy stuff. So he relocated it to New York, and I think it ended up becoming a very New York kind of movie, which was, I think, to, you know, it really kind of gave it a foundation. And it was actually Ivan Reitman who suggested that they bring in Harold Ramis, who I mentioned before, who played Egon and who ended up co-writing the screenplay. And in fact, you know, a lot of people who ended up working on the film had worked together before. You had Harold Ramis, he directed Caddyshack, which Bill Murray was in, obviously, and he co-wrote films like Meatballs and Stripes and Animal House and all that. And the first two of those, again, starred Bill Murray, and all of those films were like produced or directed by Ivan Reitman. So it was a group that really knew each other very well. I mean, a lot of them had worked in Saturday Night Live together, a lot of them had worked in the Second City comedy improv group in Chicago together, and I think that really benefited the film, you know, that kind of relaxed, easy vibe of the film. Now, someone who was supposed to be in the film, who wasn't in the film, was John Belushi, because Dan Aykroyd originally wrote it for him, and John Belushi, obviously, they had a huge success with the Blues Brothers a few years before that, but John Belushi died before the film went into production. Although the character of Slimer, which people might remember, the green, disgusting blob of a ghost that's featured prominently in the movie and in the later cartoons that came after it, that was, according to Dan Aykroyd, based on John Belushi. So John Belushi snuck into the film in a way.
Based on John Belushi.
Yeah.
Okay. Slime based on John Belushi. Okay. It was a huge hit, of course. Doesn't matter what I thought about it. Why was it so successful, and why is it still so fondly remembered, which it most definitely is?
Well, maybe, I mean, you know, based on your not liking it, maybe a factor is nostalgia. I mean, a lot of crap films from the 80s are fondly remembered by people of a certain age. So, I mean, being fondly remembered is no guarantee of quality, of course.
Yeah, it's like saying, as I said, it's a huge hit on YouTube. What isn't?
Well, I mean, I think nostalgia definitely can distort, you know, your ability to appreciate how good or bad something really was. And then when you watch it again years later, you're suddenly going, oh my God, you know, that was actually horrendous. But I think in this case, I genuinely think in this case, as with something like Back to the Future, which was released around the same time, I think the nostalgia is justified. Now, first of all, it's just a really original concept. I mean, you know, most horror comedies are spoofs of, or like piss takes of existing genres, existing horror genres. I mean, there are loads of comedy zombie films like Shaun of the Dead. There are lots of kind of tongue-in-cheek takes on the whole slasher killer thing, like the Scream movies, for example. But I think this, with this, the whole idea of, like, you know, physically trapping ghosts and proton packs and all that kind of thing, I mean, that was really novel. You know, it wasn't generic. It wasn't formulaic. And I think the heroes as well in the film, they were nicely anti-heroic. I mean, you had the kind of earnest nerds like Egon and Ray. You had guys who just wanted a job like Winston. And then you had the kind of sneery, cynical, anti-heroic types. Bill Murray, obviously, being Bill Murray.
Okay, well, listen, I'll give you a little slight, very short blast. Ghostbusters, mass hysteria.
That this city is headed for a disaster of biblical proportion.
Well, what do you mean, biblical?
What he means is Old Testament, Mr.
Yes.
Mayor. Real wrath of God type stuff.
Exactly.
Fire and brimstone coming down from the skies. Rivers and seas boiling.
40 years of darkness, earthquakes, volcanoes.
The dead rising from the grave.
Human sacrifice, dogs and cats living together. Mass hysteria.
Mass hysteria, indeed. It is a kind of an odd mix in a way. I mean, horror and comedy. It does seem to work. The two go together very often. You've mentioned a little bit there. Why is it, do you think?
Well, I mean, you know, it's easy to kind of play pop psychologist and speculate about what the connection is. I mean, you know, you could say, does laughter offer some kind of, you know, release, some kind of cathartic release from the horror? I mean, is it kind of an antidote to fears that people have, something that helps you cope with those fears? Or maybe you could suggest, like, they're two sides of the same coin, you know, comedy and horror. Like, they're both kind of transgressive, you know, in a way. They kind of unsettle the normal order of things, the day-to-day world. They kind of turn it upside down. And maybe that's what makes them kind of gel so well together. But I think, you know, what's interesting is when these waves of kind of horror comedies actually occur. And I think you could actually argue that they often occur just after periods or decades of kind of horror saturation, great horror decades. Because if you look at like the 1930s, now that was like the first great decade for cinema horror, I'd say, you know, the decade when kind of horror became a proper cinematic genre. And you had all the Universal Studios classic monster movies then, you had Dracula and The Mummy and Frankenstein being released. But then if you skip to the mid-40s, I mean, Universal Studios was churning out these kind of monster rally movies, so-called monster alley movies like Frankenstein meets the Wolfman or House of Dracula, where you get all these monsters mashed up together in the one movie.
But they
movie.
Weren't necessarily seen to be sort of ironic comedy kind of things.
No, they weren't. But then, you know, towards the end of the 40s, just after that, kind of a decade or more, you know, like after those classic kind of monsters first appeared, I think they'd become so familiar, they were so overexposed that they'd become a bit of a joke, and all audiences could do was kind of laugh. And then you had movies like towards the end of the 40s, Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, and then Abbott and Costello Meet the Invisible Man, Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy, which people might remember RT used to show these back in the day. So I think by the late 40s and early 50s, it was kind of like, you know, it had become a bit of a joke. And maybe you could argue something similar happened in the 80s, because I mean the 70s was another fantastic decade, probably the other great decade for horror, for really grim and kind of bleak and kind of violent horror, I'd say. So I think, you know, the kind of goofier, more playful movies that came along in the 80s, like Ghostbusters or Gremlins or American Werewolf in London, maybe it was an inevitable kind of reaction.
Okay, well, on what you've said, I'll just take a listen to this here from American Werewolf in London. Hold on a second.
Hello.
Alex, have you heard anything?
He's here.
Is he all right? Why didn't you call me? Where was he?
He doesn't remember. He woke up at the zoo.
The zoo? Is he rational?
Yes, he is. He's very excited and confused, but he's not crazy, if that's what you mean.
Have you read the papers today? We listen to the radio or the television?
No, why?
Is David behaving strangely?
No, he's not really. He's rather enthusiastic.
Now, could you get here without any trouble?
Yes, I should think so.
I want you to bring David here straight away. I want him in my care. I'll notify the police that we found him, but it's imperative. You bring him straight to the hospital, you understand?
Yes, Doctor.
Now, you're certain he's lucid. You won't need any help.
No, he's fine. We'll come right over.
Okay, now, American Werewolf in London. I'll tell you what, look, I'll just contrast that with this. I'm going to give you the Return of the Living Dead trailer. You can tell me if these are what you're talking about.
Okay. They only come out at night. They're mean, rude, and dead. Not them. Them.
How many did you say?
100.
The dead are refusing to remain buried.
What are we gonna do?
What are we gonna do?
We're gonna call the boss.
They've come back to life. They're hungry. And they're not vegetarians.
The graveyard out there is full of people coming out of the ground.
We have a little problem.
What the hell is going on there?
Rabid weasels.
What?
More brain.
Do you want a party? It's party time. We got a party. It's party time. Do you want a party?
They're back from the grave and ready to party.
It's party time.
The return of the living dead.
Right, the dead are refusing to remain dead. In fact, your man's voice sounds a bit like the other guy's voice, the actual actor in American Werewolf in London. That's so I think I'm getting your point here. I mean, this is what we're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think there was a two cracking examples, again, from the 80s, which I think was really got kind of the golden decade for kind of horror comedy. I think American Werewolf in London is a great kind of, you know, and really gory and hilarious take on, you know, the old universal kind of gothic horror movies I was talking about. And, you know, it has quite a kind of moving sort of love story in there in the middle of it as well, you know. And Return of the Living Dead, I think, is probably from 1985. That's Dan O'Bannon directed that. That's probably my personal favourite in terms of horror comedies. I think it was like one of the first to introduce the idea of kind of brain-eating zombies looking for brains and fast-running zombies and all that. And as you got, I heard a snippet of it there, it really has a fantastic kind of punk soundtrack. I think that was 45 Grave you heard there with Party Time. Great soundtrack and a fantastically kind of grim ending as well. So definitely be two of my favourites, yeah.
Would Evil Dead go in there? Even before I look at that, what about Cabin in the Woods bringing us right up today? Would that be one that you're talking about in terms of funny?
Yeah. Cabin in the Woods was a bit of a divisive one. Joss Whedon produced it. I mean, I really liked it. I mean, a lot of people found it very annoying. I mean, it was kind of like, you know, starts off, you think it's going to be one of these typical teens in a cabin in the woods, isolated cabin in the woods kind of thing, very formulaic, and then it just completely turns, you know, upside down and inside out. And for anyone who hasn't seen it, I won't give too much away, but basically, you know, nothing is what it appears, and I really enjoyed that. I thought that was an excellent example of them. And in terms of Evil Dead, actually, like I think Evil Dead 2, I suppose, is one of the kings of what we're talking about. I think, you know, and that's kind of, that wasn't a sequel so much as a kind of a parody remake, really, of the first film. I mean, there's even a word kind of Sam Raimi's movies like Evil Dead, Evil Dead 2. There's a word that's been kind of coined to describe them, which is splatstick, which is kind of, you know, like slapstick, except, you know, with gore. So it's kind of a mix of kind of, you know, physical comedy and.
Okay, well, I'm going to give you a little bit of that, and I'm going to ask you for just. I mean, I know you've mentioned a whole bunch now, but just of your favourites. Just before I do, I completely forgot to do the competition again, so I'm going to do it right now. So you shut up and don't answer this, by the way. Okay. You're not allowed to answer. Okay, basically, what I want to do is this. I want to send people to the Killashee House Hotel in Nason, County Kildare, 2-night break, etc., and then all the rest with them, breakfast both mornings, stay at dinner one evening, the luxurious Turner's Restaurant, etc. What you have to do is give us your name and address, 51552, and tell us who these five are for a second and last time.
Hold fast and we will watch the flames burn open all. I'm far too shy to speak to you while it's cold.
Hey, while I'm driving.
Let him know that you know best, 'cause after all,
maybe I don't really wanna know.
Okay, it's for the Killashee House Hotel in Nason, County Kildare. If you know those five, and if you know your own name, and if you know your own address, send it to 51552. And in about 3 or 4 minutes' time, do it right now. I'll be giving out the winner because the news is coming up in 4 minutes' time. Now, the last one I wanted to say to you then, John Byrne in Limerick at the moment. What, of all the ones you've mentioned, what are you talking about best if we're going to celebrate 30 years of Ghostbusters? That's right, 3-0.
For one, obviously, like I said, Return of the Living Dead would probably be my personal favourite. Evil Dead 2, another crack. American Werewolf in London, we've mentioned all these already. One I didn't get to mention was El Dia de la Bestia, which is a Spanish film from 1995, The Day of the Beast, directed by Alex de la Iglesia. That's another hilariously kind of super violent and super hilarious thing about a priest and the end of the world and all that sort of stuff. And a movie that was out a couple of years ago, Tucker and Dale versus Evil. Another really good kind of twist on teens in, you know, in the woods and all that kind of thing, and kind of like, it's like a kind of a piss take of a Texas Chainsaw Massacre kind of thing, where the bad guys aren't who you think they are and all that sort of stuff. So those would be a couple that I'd really recommend.
Alright, well, arts journalist John Byrne, you're a bit of an aficionado, no doubt, but I'll give it a little bit of Evil Dead too. Thanks, John.
No problem.
There's
cheers,
Dave. There's a tape recorder here.
See what's on it.
This is Professor Raymond Nobe, Department of Ancient History, log entry number 2. I believe I have made a significant find in the castle of Kandar, having journeyed there with my wife Henrietta, my daughter Annie, and Associate Professor Ed Gettley. was in the rear chamber of the castle, we stumbled upon something remarkable. Naturam de Monto, the Book of the Dead. My wife and I brought the book to this cabin, where I could study it undisturbed. It was here that I began the translations. The book speaks of a spiritual presence, a thing of evil that roams the forests and the dark bowers of man's domain. It is through the recitation of the book's passages that this dark spirit is given license to possess the living.